Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. We are a part of it wherever you are, and shalom, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network. We are making great radio for you, great podcasts, so that you can be connected to the story of Israel from wherever you are as well. And welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom, and welcome to Spiritual Cafe. Good to have you. And, of course, we're at Pardes, the Pardes Institute. What's the website again there?
It's pardes.org.il.
Pardes.org.il. Lots of great stuff coming out of here. And we're in the Talpiot neighborhood of Jerusalem, and we're going to study the Torah portion together. And this week's Torah portion is one that I have a special connection to, and that is because I lived in the town of Beit El for 8 years of my life, in this beautiful town of Beit El. Beit El, for some reason, which means the house of God, is a name that is very popular in the world. There are many, many churches named Bethel. There are many, many temples and synagogues named Bethel. Bethel, there's towns, I think 8 in America, called Bethel. Well,
who doesn't want to live in the house of God?
The house of God, right. Bethel, Beit El, the house of God. And I actually got to live for 8 years in this place, very close to where we believe the dream of the ladder actually took place. We have many reasons for that there in Beit El to believe that. And so the story in this Torah portion became, this one and the next one, which both deal with the town of Beit El, became a part of my consciousness. So much so that I was listening to OU Radio. OU Radio, by the way, has great daily Torah portion learning from Mishnah Yomi to Nach Yomi to the Talmud page. Daily study. Fantastic. And I was listening to the famous Tanakh teacher Menachem Liebtag. And Menachem Liebtag was talking about Beit El, and I think I caught him making a very rare mistake, because he's a great teacher, a great Tanakh knower. But he's saying that Abraham was also in Beit El. That is not true, at least the way I understand that is not true. Abraham was in a place close to Beit El, Bein Ha'ai u'Bein Beit El, between the eye and Beit El. We think that place that the Torah is talking about is probably this very tall mountain called Baal Chatzor, which is to the north of Beit El, and from which you can really see the whole land all the way to Jordan. In fact, the military's got a flight intelligence gathering place.
Outpost.
Right. And there was a cultic site, and we think that that's where Abraham was. But nobody went to Beit El except for Yaakov. In the five books of Moses, in the story of Bereishit Genesis. Nobody goes there except for Jacob, for Yaakov. Why? This is his communal spot. This is where he gets connectivity.
His connection.
It's his place. It's like his place. Now, the other problem about that is that there's a relationship between Beit El and the house of God, which is not in Beit El. It's in Jerusalem. And the temple that is the under theme here, the hidden theme of this week's Torah portion, the temple in Jerusalem that will exist, is not in a place called the House of God, Beit El, which is about 20 kilometers north of Jerusalem.
I mean, it's a complex story. It gets even worse when you go forward later in the history of the Israelite people, because in the time of the divided kingdom, so now we're speaking about, let's call it the 9th century before the Common Era, you know, Yeravam, when the northern kingdom of Israel splits off from the Davidic line, Yeravam will establish an idolatrous temple in Beit El, which indicates to most archaeologists and historians that there was some long time place of worship there. So it's hard to know. And Yaakov, of course, doesn't go there, I would say. He happens upon it. And I think that's such a critical element of what it is he finds there, is that when it says, Vayivga b'makon, right, that he just encountered the place, that's going to be definitive of the path of avoda, path of divine service that Yaakov forges.
Which is what?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, we're going to
You mean that sometimes you get like, I'm just guessing what you're talking about. Are you talking about that there's some element which has to be something that happens to you and not something that you can plan out, something that is a kind of primal and not exactly planned out. What the rabbis tell us in the Ethics of Our Fathers, don't make your tefillah to kavua, to keva,
fixed,
but rather has to
be supplications of the heart. That's definitely an element. I think you have to remember that Abraham, his relationship to God was calling out, right? We call Hashem, we see this from Abraham all the time. Yitzchak, his relationship to God was he gave it all up for God, right? To the point where he was there on the altar, right? Yaakov is living God. Wherever he is, he's encountering God. And that is why I believe that this moment precedes what he would have thought to be a disaster. Remember, Yaakov has never known anyone who left the land. Well, he may have met Abraham in his very young years, but his father, Yitzchak, specifically never left. And here he is. The great tragedy of his life is about to unfold because he has to leave the land.
Right. Let's help the listeners understand what's going on. Let's back up a little bit. Last time we left off Jacob and Esau, that's right, we had a little situation in which Rebecca tells Yaakov, Jacob, she says to him, go into your father's tent. He's blind. Put on these goat skins and make sure to get the blessing.
Pull the wool over his eyes.
Pull the wool over your hands and neck and then over his eyes. And then he gets the blessing. We talked about that extensively last week. And before he went into that tent, he said to his mom, are you sure you won't be bringing a curse upon me? Right? You're not going to be, you know, bringing a curse upon me. She says, no, don't worry about it. The curse is going to be upon me. I told you last week that the word Alai could also mean the curse shall be Esav, Lavan, and Yosef, the problems that you're going to have in life. But in any case, she makes him a simple promise. It's going to be okay. Next thing he knows, when he comes out of that tent, his mom's like, look, Esav wants to kill you. You got to go, boy. And within just a little bit, he finds himself out of the house. The Medrash also says that when he's out of the house, Esav's son, Eliphaz, catches up with him, and by the commandment of his father, he's supposed to kill him. And Yaakov is like, you're not going to kill your uncle. Come on, that's not right. And he's like, yeah, but I got to fulfill my father's wishes. So he says, take all my money. And that way, it's like I'm dead, because a poor person is like he's dead. And Eliphaz is satisfied with that, but that leaves Yaakov indigent.
Penniless and on the road.
Penniless, on the road, so much so that he's lying down at this nighttime scene, basically without pillow or blanket. Now this is a Yoshev Ohalim. He's a tent dweller, okay? He likes
the good life.
He likes the nice sheets, you know what I mean? And suddenly he's out on his own, and he's probably thinking to himself, Boy, was that not worth it? Boy, did that work out bad. A minute ago, my dad blessed me, but really it was all through trickery. And now I find myself without my family, without my home, heading outside, as you just pointed out, Rabbi Mike, outside of the land of Israel. And then God appears to him. He appears to him in this place. And that's going to be this incredibly dramatic scene that we see, in which Yaakov is heading towards Haran. The sun sets kind of quickly. He takes from the rocks of the plural, the rocks of the place, puts them around his head to protect himself from like animals chewing on his face or something, and he lies in that place, Bamakom. And suddenly he sees an incredible vision. He sees a ladder who on the one hand is grounded with its feet on the ground, on the other hand its head is in the heavens, and he sees the angels of God going up and down on this ladder. This is an incredible image that he sees. What is it? What is the meaning of this? Or let's begin to deal with this. I mean, the word sulam, which means ladder, is even the name of a commentary on the Zohar. So I just mean to say that when we say what is the meaning of the ladder between heaven and earth, it's not going to be, you know, a simple one-line answer.
It's true, although I feel quite connected to it, because as a founding member and educational director of Sulam Yaakov, my own Beit Midrash, we set out on the mission to do what I believe is the simplest sense of this ladder, which is connect between heaven and earth.
Right.
Right? It's a sulam mutzav arza. It's firmly established on the ground, but its head's in the heavens. Right. And I believe that in many ways this is the emblem of Yaakov's path, which become the path of Am Yisrael, is that our sense of the divine is not found by leaving the world. Right? Nor is our passion and engagement of the world found by turning our back on God, but that we seek God in the world. We seek to bring God into. That is the mission of the Jewish people, to connect between heaven and earth. And Yaakov receives this message, I believe, at this point in his life, because he might think, oh, I get it. My dad gave me that blessing. And if you recall, the words of the blessing are very physical, right? It's the dew and the rains and the fat of the land, etc. And he at first he probably thought, well, that sounds like a really good life. Oh, suddenly I'm on the road. Oh, it must be that I misunderstood. That was all metaphoric, right? It was all allegory. Really, what I was blessed with is some sort of divine vision, and I have to, like, ignore the world. I'm supposed to live in misery and poverty in order to free my soul. Then God shows them the vision and says, no, you don't get it. I gave you that blessing, and that is exactly what I meant. You are going to get the land with all the good richness of the physical world it involves, but your task is to connect it to me. And so in order to do that, you got to learn a little bit about life. So I'm going to let you see what it feels like to really be on the run, to really be alone, to have to make yourself like your brother, who's Esau. He's a sui. He's a self-made man, right? But on that level, the very simple beginning level.
What about angels going up and down?
Okay, so the next level is there's a number of directions we can go with the angels. Right? One of the visions that the sages offer us is that what Yaakov was offered here is a vision of history. And that the angels are, you know, in Hebrew, a malachim, right? They're divine messengers is the literal translation. And in that sense, history is a divine message. Right? We believe that history is an unfolding of God's will. And so the ups and downs of history are meant to be read as God's will, but not in a simple sense. It's a longer discussion. If you're interested, by the way, you can check out my Jewish story podcast here on the Land of Israel Network and get a picture of what I mean. Yaakov was also enjoined with the task of understanding that nations will come and nations will go, and that his people's task is to stay focused on the goal, right? Keep your eyes on the prize. It's very easy, and we see in the past generations, we see it today, how the intellectual or material or cultural trends of the time, which seem so true and compelling, and often are very true in certain elements, should not divert us from the primary task of connecting between heaven and earth.
All right, that's a relatively esoteric way of understanding the angels. I mean, and powerful, you know, that Jewish,
no
Jewish, yeah, Jewish history keeps going, and there's going to be all kinds of angels. There's going to be all kinds of nations. There's going to be all kinds of challenges along the way. But I think that there's for the kind of person thinking about this in the beginning, it's we're talking about that. We live in a world where people are agnostic, or what's that one that people believe that God created the world and then let it go?
Deism,
okay? So a lot of people are just like, God is invisible. I don't see him. I don't see him in my life. I don't believe in all this stuff. And what the vision of the latter is like, no, I am very much involved in this world. I'm mm-hmm. sending down and up. I'm getting up messages from you guys, and I'm connecting to you, and I'm sending action figures, action doers down there, and that is these angels. I think also that in the past, the Kabbalists understood Beit El and the ladder to be like an umbilical cord. That was the likeness between heaven and earth. Today, I'm thinking it's a little bit more like internet packets, internet information that's being sent down. Like I'm sending down messages, I'm getting messages. We're constantly connected. We're not the same. There's a heavenly abode. There's a lower abode. You know, I'm not dwelling with you down here in a, like, I don't belong down here. I'm sending down my messengers, and I hear your prayers, and I hear and I see your actions. They affect me as well. It is a radical, just for people to understand, Islam in general, Islamic thinking, does not really believe that you can change God's mind, that you can supplicate and change. You can only accept, basically. That's their basic idea, that you can basically accept.
So they tilt toward determinism? I wasn't aware of that.
They don't believe that you can really change Allah's mind. It is mm-hmm. written. It is written, and like best you could do is change yourself. That's the way they...
Which is good advice.
It's good advice. That's right. Don't try to change God's mind. People always say to me, from your mouth to God's ears. So I always say to him, from God's mouth to your ears.
Yeah.
Or to our ears. If we can get past the first one, well, maybe we can get to the second one, or the other way. But in any case, there's angels connecting in this world.
And I want to pause on that because there's a beautiful symmetry between the brothers in that sense of Yishmael, right? That who God hears, that's his name, Yishmael. Right? God hears, and yet you're saying that his descendants. Their attitude toward prayer is that prayer is a process of self-transformation because you're not going to change God.
Or submission.
Submission. Right? And his great, his nephew, not his great nephew, right? Yisrael, who's struggling with God, right? And what's the connection to Beit El? Is that the primary thing that connects heaven and earth is will, right? That we as a people have been pushing the oneness of God for a long time, right? And sometimes with more success, sometimes with less. But it's important to remember that our notion of the oneness of God is a moral oneness, right? It's not about physics or metaphysics or complex philosophical systems. That stuff, in the end of the day, will remove the personal God you're speaking about. Because if I believe that in a metaphysical sense, all creation is one, right, then the best thing I can do is cease to exist in order to prove that, right? But if I believe in a moral sense that all creation is one, meaning there is one will which both creates the stars and the sun and the moon and guides my actions and in turn allows me the freedom to choose, well, then prayer becomes critical. Because the closer I come to aligning my will with God's will, right, the more powerful the act of prayer can be. And that is what happened to Yaakov in that moment. Because what does he wake up and say?
He says that there was God in this place. I didn't even know it.
Right, but and if I had known it, what? I never would have laid down to sleep.
Either. Right.
Meaning, why did he lay down to sleep? He was exhausted. I mean, it was a very natural thing. He's running scared. His nephew just took everything he owns. He's like, it's time. I'm going to bed. Right. But what does he say? He says, if I really appreciated the fact that heaven and earth connect, then my will would have been otherwise. I would not have been exhausted.
This is also a great slap in the face to those who we talked about, the deists. But there's another one, which is what you're touching on now, Rabbi Mike, which is this place has got that ability. I would have thought, oh my God, I had a vision and a dream. God connects with heaven and earth everywhere equally. And he's like, no. He's like, this place that I lay down in, this place, it has a specific energy. It has a specific portal and an ability. It's an opening.
This has been our great conflict with Christianity and its inheritors in Western culture for a long time, because the idea of sanctity of place, right? And that battle goes all the way back to the question of whether the words of the text matter, whether the actions of the commandments matter, or whether they're not just allegorical representations of some spiritual truth. Right, we say, by the way, we have a midrashic understanding. There's absolutely deeper, more refined, sometimes more spiritual truths there. But the word doesn't cover them over. It allows you contact with them, right? Because the point of contact is what allows for real relationship. And that's the thing is, God, listen, absolutely you can connect heaven and earth anywhere. But you need to know that it's possible somewhere before you can do such a thing, right? And the lesson of the Mikdash, of the idea of a place, of a temple, which actually connects between heaven and earth, is to sanctify the holiness on the level where you can have a real experience, which will then allow you to do such a thing wherever you may be. It's transformative.
But there is a specific place that is more of a gateway to God than other places.
Because it opens that potentiality to the world as a whole. That's what we mean when we say that our prayers pass through. Right. Right? We always joke, right, here in Israel, Your prayers are a local call,
it's a
long distance. You know, it's because the connection there makes it even possible for such a thing to be.
So God says to him, after showing him this prelude, this kind of, let's call it a GIF, you know, a kind of, you know, a JPEG, a picture to understand what we're talking about. And this, by the way, goes to just parenthetically, I just want to say, I'm thinking about writing and speaking and presenting and radio and video and other ways. I've learned one thing is always true. First give me a story, then give me the theory. Don't give me the theory and then somewhere down the line give me the story. A story gives you the context for the whole thing. He gives him first an image. That's the image I want you to – you got it. You got the picture. Good. That's the storyline. Then he gives him narrative. And he says here God appears upon him. And he says, I am the God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land which you lay upon it, to you I will give and to your seed. And your seed shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall expand greatly. North, Yama v'ked metzafona v'negba, which is really west, east, north, and south. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed through you and through your seed. And I'm going to be with you, and I'm going to take you wherever you go. I'm going to protect you wherever you go, and I'm going to return you to this place. Remember that for later in this discussion today with Rabbi Mike. I'm going to return you to this place. For I shall not leave you up until the time which I have fulfilled what I have promised you. Okay, I'm going to bring you back to this place now. Now, the text of what I just read is certainly a conversation between God and Jacob, the individual. But it's also clearly a discussion about the nation, because it talks about your seed and your progeny. And I'm going to bring you back. It's not just going to bring Jacob back, which I will, but I'm going to bring the people back. There will be exile in the Jewish story. And that goes back to what you were talking about, history. There will be exile in Jewish history. In fact, you'll probably live more of your life outside of the land of Israel than inside, at least so far in Jewish history. But I'm not going to leave you until I fulfilled what I promised you to bring you back to this land. Folks, if you believe what I just read, if you believe the Bible is written by God, it's like, there's the promise. I'm going to bring you back to this land. And when you're living in that time, you got to be minimally wowed by it. It's like, oh, more. This is huge. This is huge, okay? This is it, okay? I'm going to bring you back to this land, which I promised you. And that is the end of the kind of monologue. So the monologue from God, God's side, the God side, because there's going to be a dialogue. There's going to be, or at least Jacob's
responding monologue. Right?
But like that's basically it. See the ladder and understand everything that means. And then basically you're going to go into exile. I'm not going to leave you. I'm going to be with you. You're going to, you know, and through your seed is going to be blessed the whole world. And I'm going to bring you back to this land. That's God's side of the tale here.
It's God's side of the tale. And this word makom, right, a place, I think plays a very important part, because it's a strange promise. You're going to go away, but I'm going to be with you. And almost the sign that I'll be with you is that I'll bring you back here, right? And I think it's important to understand that makom, of course, is a very important name of God. It's also a name of a very specific place, which is Yerushalayim, and in particular, the Temple Mount. Right, when we speak about makom, like when the rabbi spoke about ha-makom with that he-yidiyah, the definite article, right? They were speaking about two things. They were speaking about the Holy of Holies, and they were speaking about God, who is the place of the world. So it's a little bit strange. It's like, is this a specific place, or is it actually the context for all places? Right? Is Yaakov going into exile, and he's going to be alone? Or, no, you're going into exile, but I'll be with you. Why? Because God is showing him the context which is meant to hold all this experience. That's what makom is. Makom is the frame. It's the frame of reference. And what he's doing is saying, listen, you might get very narrow in what's happening to you now, right? You got the blessing, but it fell apart. You're on the run. You're going into exile. Listen, might be you just cut the best deal you can. I mean, who knows if you're ever going to come back? Maybe just find yourself a comfy spot, settle down, and just lay low, you know? And God's telling him, no. You need to see the big picture in order that that picture be what informs your individual actions. It's a big challenge I see in a lot of our brothers and sisters today, who even here, but certainly those who struggle to get here, is that there are 1,001 good reasons not to do the right thing. You know, and if I keep my frame local in my own life, if I think about just taking care of my kids or just paying my bills or, you know, or the mortgage or my own personal career track, sometimes things will come across something as simple as an opportunity to do an act of chesed. I don't know if this ever happens to you. You have an opportunity to do an act of loving kindness, generosity, and you say to yourself, I don't actually have time for that.
I don't have the bandwidth.
I don't have the capacity for it, right? And often that is a true observation, but it is gained by narrowing the frame of reference by which I'm making my decision. Because if I just stop for a minute and say, whoa, wait, this is why God created me. God didn't create me to make a living. He didn't even necessarily create me to have children. That's a mitzvah, but it's not why necessarily I was created. God created me to do the right thing in the right place at the right time, and that might just be this. And suddenly my whole context expands, and I'm being held by the makom, that place. And that's what God's saying to Yaakov. He said, listen, the biggest danger of going into exile is not exile. The biggest danger of going into exile is to thinking it's no longer exile. So I want you to remember that this is where you're from, because ironically, it's only when you understand you came from somewhere that exile is exile as opposed to just the future. You know, holding that memory of where he's trying to get back to is what makes where he's going exile itself.
That's a very good point. And we'll also see the contrast later on between the dream of the ladder and then the dream of the sheep. And the commentators say, well, you see what happens when you live in exile for too long.
You dream about sheep?
You dream about sheep and mundane things as opposed to dreaming and how to, you know, make a buck as opposed to dreaming about God. In any case, as you just said, Rabbi Mike, and you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer, talking about Parshat Vayetze, which is chapter 28 in the book of Genesis. We're talking about we've shifted tracks from very quickly Isaac. Doesn't get a lot role. He's in one Torah portion, Toldot. We talked about it last week. Now we're going to be talking about Jacob, and really for the rest of the book of Genesis, about Jacob and his progeny. Jacob just started being a man, you know, because he's on his own now, and he's heading out to Haran. I also think one could deduce that he was depressed. There was a depressing moment. And I read that also in some Hasidic stuff, that this was a depressing moment until God shows up to him and he gives him this great vision, give him this great idea, direction, and then he's going to go in that trajectory and come back through that trajectory. And here comes Jacob, and he is very moved by this vision, and he doesn't just kind of shoo away and say, weird dream at night, no biggie. He says, wow, this place is, how awesome is this place? Is this not the house of God, and this is the gate of the heavens? I just remembered that the town of Jericho is considered the gate to the land of Israel. That's where, yes, Joshua came. There was always a road between Jericho and Bethel. I've even walked that road, and it's like the gate of Eretz Yisrael, the lowest place, to one of the highest Jewish communities that exist in Beit El, which is the gate of the heavens. In any case, he gets up in the morning. He takes now the stone. Dun, dun, dun. Before it was stones, plural. Now it has fused into one stone, which was around his head. And he puts this stone as a an eternal... What's that called?
Marker,
pillar. What do they call it here?
Memorial,
pillar. And he pours oil on it. I heard Rabbi Liebtag say that oil lasts kind of like, if you pour oil on a stone, it lasts kind of forever. I don't know if it's going to last for 20 years, but in any case, he anoints it. And he calls the name of the place Beit El. But really, the name of the place was Luz originally. Which everybody, I make this joke every year, everybody in Beit El is so happy because they were going to be called losers if they would be living there. And now they're called Beit Elians, the house of God. But in any case, he really does change the name of the place, and he's able to uncover a different spiritual meaning of the place. And here he keeps going, and he makes a vow, and he says, if God will be with me and protect me on the way, which I am going, which I'm walking, and give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I shall return to this, my father's house, and God shall be with me. This stone, which I made into a pillar, will be a house of God, and everything that you give me, I shall surely tithe to you. And Jacob raised his feet and was with light fleet footedness was able to go to the east. To the land between the rivers. But basically, he makes a kind of declaration here.
A declaration of vow. And there's something vaguely problematic. I don't know if you sense it in the words of the if-then sort of reading.
There's a lot of if-then. God also says, I won't release you until I fulfilled what I promised you. And he says, this quid pro quo is there's if-then.
I mean, listen, for God to do such a thing, I think we can understand. But for Jacob to say, basically, listen, God, if you take care of me, then you'll be my God.
Mm-hmm.
It's always bothered me, and there are a few ways you can do it. One is very simple, which might just be an observation that, like, well, if I make it, well, then I'll come back, and right, you'll be my God. And right, if I don't, well, then I don't.
Right.
But on a deeper level, I think that here we see that the core of Yaakov's mission, which he's inherited really definitely from Abraham, is that he's heading out into an unknown. And that's what it is to be Yaakov and his children, Bnei Yisrael, is that there's a promise, so on one hand we're holding fast. On the other hand, we know somehow that promise actually doesn't dictate success, right? And because of that, it empowers us to actually build a whole world as opposed to just be a passive recipient or some sort of like strange marionette that God's pulling the strings of. At the same time, it's quite frightening. quite frightening. I mean, here we are in the midst of what you have, I think, rightly named the great project, right, of the Jewish people. And at the same time, we know that God has promised this is going to work out. But it's not a guarantee that it will for you and I.
Not at all.
Not at all.
It is on the grand scheme, it is. And it's, but by the way, that reminds me of a very famous theological problem that a great Jew named Elisha ben Abuya had. He once saw a young boy doing the will of his father. Kibud Avim, he was honoring his father by going up on a ladder and trying to get trying to shoo away a mother bird and get its eggs or its chicks, and fulfilling these two commandments, which are specifically the ones that say that you will get lengthened days. And this boy, somehow the ladder breaks, or the boy slips, and the boy breaks his neck and dies. And Elisha ben Abuya sees this, and he's like, there is no judge. There's no judgment, and there's no judge. And he becomes
heretic.
A heretic, a scoffer, whatever. Not a scoffer, because he wasn't really a scoffer, but he was a heretic. In any case, to me, if you ever want to kind of explore this a little more, there's a famous book which I know you read, as a Driven Leaf, which is a book I liked when I was younger. But in any case, to me, this was always like, I always wanted to grab Elisha ben Abuya, who was a genius and a Torah scholar far and above what we can appreciate.
He's one of the authors of the Mishnah,
right? So please take this as really with a grain of salt. What I mean to say, I always wanted to grab him by the lapels and say, dude, what that meant was not on the individual level. It meant on a national level. If we're a nation of people that honor their parents, if we're a nation of people that are kind, that shoo away the mother bird, we're kind to the bird. By the way, my mother always says that the shooing away the mother bird is also a recycling issue, which is like the mother will have more children, and therefore you're only taking what you need for the day, and then there's...
That itself provides for sustainability.
A sustainability paradigm there. And it's not about the individual. It's not about you. But here with regarding to Yaakov, it is about Yaakov, the man, because without him, there is no Jewish nation. So he needs some personal sustenance.
It's an interesting angle on the story of Elisha ben Abuya, because that was the time in history when the Chachamim were really beginning to explore what I would call post-biblical theology. Right? As the imminent destruction of the temple was approaching, and there was an awareness that we needed to dig deeper into our tradition to understand how we could, as individuals, without the national center of the temple or the national vessel of the land, how we could have a meaningful relationship with God. I've never really thought about that angle of the story. But here with Yaakov at the beginning, it is an individual relationship,
within him is the whole nation.
Yeah, and part of the way I answer this quandary of how he's making deals with God is that a neder really is a way of binding heaven and earth. We see it in the story of Hannah when she basically backs God into a corner and says, "You must give me a child." We see it in the tragic story of Yiftach when he ends up perhaps sacrificing his daughter. Right, but that a vow is a power of binding, and historically and legally, halakhically, we make vows when we need to strengthen ourselves, and I think that that's really what's happening here.
I'm going on a journey outside of the land of Israel, and I need you to take me there and bring me back so I can do this thing for you. I want to do it, but I can't do it without your blessings. And I'm going to a dark place for
you. I'm afraid.
I'm 100% afraid.
That's a phrase that gets repeated throughout the Navi. Al tira av di Yaakov, right? Don't be afraid, Yaakov.
That's right. All right, we're going to have to go a little quicker through the next part of the story, which is that, and I'm very happy that we tarried here on the ladder, and it's an important, because it's
tarried
such
on the way.
Yeah, that's right. It's such an important it's something that we should all put in our heads. That's why you named your yeshiva Sulam Yaakov. But it's the ladder is something we should. I think that the Torah is actually telling us, if you're going to meditate and spend some time meditation, here's a good one. Here's an image
for you.
Here's a good one. Think about this. Any case, just like we had this special rock that became, from many rocks, became one rock, we're going to meet another rock right now, and that is that Yaakov is going to head out towards Haran, and there he is going to get to a place where it all happens. It all happens at the bar of yesteryear, right? At the watering hole, literally. And in this case, it's not a spring. Rather, it is
a cistern.
A cistern. That's right. And And there's a big rock on. He gets to this place. There's a lot of other flocks and sheep herders. And before they can get the flock out of here, then they have to roll this.
Before they can roll?
That's right. They need to flock and roll, basically. They have to roll this big giant stone off of the top of this cistern. He sees Rachel coming. Jacob sees Rachel coming, and it's one of these things, just like we saw when Rebecca saw a faraway distance. She saw Yitzchak, and she was moved by that. He sees her. He becomes like Superman, and this is what we learn about Yaakov, is that actually Yaakov and Jacob and Israel is Clark Kent and Superman. He sees Rachel. He's like, I am Superman. He lifts up this rock right off of the well, although I saw in the movie Jacob by Turner Classics that he basically was wiser than the other sheep herders, and he basically put the animals to, he was able to kind of lasso them.
That's an interesting parish.
Yeah, it was an interesting parish. But in any case, but on the simple level, he lifts up the rock himself, and there comes Rachel. He sees Rachel, a nuclear explosion happens, he gives her a kiss, and he wow. cries out a cry. It's like, I'm like, whoa, Jacob.
Calm down.
Simmer down. But he is just like, when he sees Rachel, it's like the whole thing flashes in front of him. The whole thing. And he's
the rest of history, actually.
Right. And he's desperately in love with this woman.
And yet he cries because he knows that they won't be buried together in the end.
That's right.
I want to just.
I'm just like, it's like reading this part of the Torah is like, whoa, 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 whoa. Just calm down. I'm just trying to relax here. It's like so emotional. You could just feel it. And in such terse words, you understand the nuclear emotional explosion that happened here.
It's powerful. I'm still stuck on the flocking and the rock, because I think the simplest understanding here is actually not. I mean, the Midrash says exactly what you said. Far be it for me to argue with the rabbis, but since they argued with each other, I point out that the simple reading here is that why were all these shepherds waiting to roll the rock off? Because they weren't allowed to until everyone got there. It was a social convention.
Right.
It was a work contract agreement here. Yaakov is always the one who disrupts these things. That's part of his way. Oh, the firstborn's supposed to win? No, sorry, that's just not how I go. Right? You guys are waiting around. No, I'm sorry, this is what needs to be done now. And it's consistent in its people today. I mean, if you think about it, we've been swimming upstream for as long as there's been a river. Right? And it behooves us to not just accept that, but to appreciate that that's the power we bring to the world. Because the problem of swimming with the stream is that you never actually get anywhere new.
So he's breaking social conventions. I like that very much, and I think that's true. Although it's a kind of social convention which I can totally understand, though. It's like,
it was reasonable. No, it wasn't a bad thing.
Reasonable social convention there. And, of course, we also hearken. It hearkens a little bit also towards that social convention that Moses is going to break also at the well later on with the daughters of Midian who are being pushed around by the Midianites. Any case, he sees Rachel. Rachel goes back to her brother, to her father, Lavan. And to make a long story short, Yaakov is going to become a sheep herder in Lavan's house. Lavan is going to realize that he's poor, this Yaakov, and he's going to end up working. And when the question is asked, what will be your pay? Yaakov says, I want your daughter, Rachel. Yaakov is going to work for Rachel for 7 years. It's going to feel like just but a few days. And then famously, on the wedding night, somehow, Lavan, Laban, who is a known trickster, Yaakov,
the deceiver.
The deceiver, Yaakov, the clever. I like the British clever.
Clever boy.
Clever, that's right. He's met his match in this amazingly clever Lavan, Laban. And in this moment he switches instead of Rachel, it's Leah. Somehow though, Jacob doesn't seem to notice. Our tradition is, which is really weird, our tradition is, the only explanation is that Rachel gives Leah these signs. She gives him whatever signs that they had, that they had some kind of
secret code,
and maybe they spoke Esperanto. I don't know what it was, but somehow they were able to Pig Latin, they were able to give each other some kind of secret signs. And Rachel, if that's true, in a dastardly kind of move, you know, towards Jacob, seemingly.
or with real empathy and compassion for her sister, who was going to have a very awkward moment when, in the middle of the night, Yaakov said, "You're not my wife." Kicked her out of the tent.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of darkness in this scene, remember, because that's the sort of unstated context here, is that this all takes place in the ancient world. The lamps go out. It's really dark in the tent.
Right.
So there's a lot of angst here, and there's a beauty of Rachel's character, which is a little bit hard to understand in the later scenes as they begin to compete for the love of their husband. You never hear Rachel say, "Well, the reality is he never wanted to marry you."
Not only that, but you're gonna hear her voice in the Medrash when God is angry at the Jewish people for serving idols. You're going to hear Rachel's voice. Rachel is the only one who God is listening to, because she says, "Hey, I brought my sister into my tent, gave her to my husband, all for the sake of the Jewish people. I let this competitor, you two can let a, kind of, you know, a little bit of
loosen up.
Yeah, loosen up. Like, these people are trying to, they have idol worship, but you know, don't smash them for that." Well, anyway, one of the misconceptions that people have is that in order to marry Rachel, he had to work another 7 years until he married her. That's not correct. It was about a week later. There was, and we learned from that, by the way, a week of celebration for a wedding, and then Jacob gets Rachel as his wife, but he owes 7 years more work, and then later on he's going to work for yet another 6 years. For his own wealth, basically
make a little nest egg.
Right. At the same time, Laban is also, Lavan is going to give two handmaidens to aides to his daughters, Rachel and Leah, and these two other women are going to also be the mothers of the Jewish people.
Absolutely.
Why isn't that more stressed in Judaism? What happens to the... How come they don't make it in as like part of the pantheon of our mothers exactly?
Well, I mean, one could take a number of tacks. Number one, they're not actually wives. I mean, this is a consistent sort of mechanism we see back from Avram and Hagar, the maidservant, and it, you danced around the world, but the word is really slave.
It doesn't say slave anymore. It's a handmaidden. It's a servant of some kind.
But it's a servitude. It's not a hired position.
Right.
Right. They're given as possessions.
Right.
And so therefore,
yeah, I did dance around it.
The status there is completely different. Number one. Number two, I think that there is enough conflict between the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel that the two sort of like midrashically develop yet another rift between all the 12 sons of Yaakov. Was there's probably a disincentive for that. Also, their personality doesn't come through in the narrative.
Right.
I mean, that's probably the simplest reason.
Right, that's a good point. That's right. So we have Zilpah.
The way they're presented is they are subsidiary to the women who are their masters.
That's right. And yet, though, biologically speaking, they're the ones who are going to give birth to
a significant number of the tribes.
Right. And they're not buried, by the way, in Marat HaMachpelah either. And there is, according to the Arizal, graves for them in the north of Israel for Bilhah and Zilpah. But in any case, honorable mention here, for sure. Let's remember,
I mean,
that.
Four out of the 12 tribes, that's good work.
Right. Now, here is going to happen what I call a Jewish capitalism, right? Like Jewish competitive economy. See, the sisters are going to compete with one another. They're like, "Oh yeah, I'll have another baby. Oh yeah, I'm going to have another baby." And through competition, they build the Jewish people. They're all competing for Yaakov's love. Love in those times, and maybe even today, is through the ability to have children and to continue the line. And they're in this competition between one another. And in this tension in this family, is, you would call it dysfunctional. To me, being Jewish and living in Jewish families, I would just call it
pretty normal.
Yeah. People, that's a dysfunctional family. I'm like, get out of here. It's totally normal.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think that's an exclusively Jewish phenomenon. I suspect it's just a human one.
Right. You're probably right. You know, people always say to me, they're like, "Wow, I moved into this town and there's politics there." I'm like, this is a joke. Do you not know there's politics everywhere in every building, in every shul, in every
as soon as you have two people, you have politics.
Yeah, especially Jewish people in Israel. Just know this. There's going to be politics, and it's okay. Okay? It's okay. Any case, they're going to have these competing children, including such prominent names as Judah, who is from the from Leah, and also Levi, who's going to be the kind of 10th child, and altogether, if you count them all, and he's going to be the Miser child, the kind of tithe child. We learned about tithing just earlier on. So Levi's going to become the tithe child. In any case, there's a lot of jealousy and tension between these two women and their handmaidens, their servants.
There's also a very important piece of naming. There's a theme of naming that runs through the whole book of Bereishit, which is a little bit beyond the scope, I think, of what we can get into now, but it's worth it to note that from the time God brought the animals to Adam, we've seen that it's a primary human capacity in relating to the world to name things. And the book of Bereishit is full that people's names are being changed, people are giving each other names. Here we get a singular list of all the tribes, well, not quite all yet, but and each of them not only gets a name, but the explanation, which is a beautiful insight, because here the explanations relate to what? What are they about?
About the intra-family tensions.
Exactly. But at the end of the book of Bereishit, Yaakov is going to bless each of the sons according to their name, and it's actually about them. It's a beautiful insight. Like, is your name actually about the person who gave it to you? I mean, you were 8 days old, I assume, when you got your name.
Yes.
Your parents didn't really know you all that well. How could they know that you'd really be Yishai?
That's right.
Right? At the same time, at this point in your life, are you really Yishai?
Sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what you see in the brothers here. They, when they're named, it's not about them. It's about Rachel and Leah and their competition. At the end of their lives, Yaakov is able to bless them all and seeing, yes, you are truly Reuven.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And some of these names are a little bit like, you know, Naphtali, I like fought with my sister. And
it's not all positive.
It's not all positive.
Nor is everything Yaakov has to say at the end of the book of Bereishit all positive.
Right, right. And they also make a contrast between that and what Moshe says, which is the blessings of the tribes, much more positive.
Because he also leaves out at least one that he wasn't interested in blessing.
Okay, Moshe. All right, so in any case, let's get to just a few more issues here. First thing is that this Torah portion is the Torah portion of the IVF and people who are having a hard time conceiving, and how do you conceive? There are two, just like there were two stones that we dealt with. We dealt with the big, you know, covering stone, and we dealt with the stone of that became a pillar. So too, we have here two tales of how should we say fertility treatments. Okay, one fertility treatment is the famous fertility treatment of the mandrake. Okay, and that is the Dudaim, which my father studied extensively. And that is what was in from time immemorial considered a aphrodisiac / something that could help you conceive. Well, those two things were also considered related, and that is basically that Leah is trying to draw the love of it's Leah. She's trying to draw the love of Yaakov, her son. Reuven finds it in the field. By the way, my father told me, when do you find the mandrake in the field? Only exactly when it says that, then in Ketzir Chitim, exactly after the cutting of the wheat. Only then can you find it, because just a day later, the animals and the birds just eat it away. So you cannot find those fruits. No. The Torah tells you exactly when to find it in the land of Israel. It's an amazing thing. In any case, he gives it to his mother. Her sister sees that she's using this aphrodisiac, and she asks for this aphrodisiac either to maybe spare her sister of needing this kind of stuff, or maybe to use it for herself. Hard to know. But in any case, Leah is going to call out Jacob and say, "Tonight you're with me, because I've given it up through the sale or the giving away of my son's Dudaim, the mandrake." Reminds us also a little bit about Yaakov and the soup. It's like, I got this thing, and I'm going to draw you in right now.
Yeah, I always find it a little bit heartbreaking, not only this scene, but also what you hear in the names of her children. It's like, oh, now God's given me a son, and my husband will love me. Oh, now my husband's going to listen to me because I have to. Right? My husband's going to can be milave oti, right? He's going to escort me because I have three. It's really heartbreaking. You see how Leah really entered into this relationship.
Hated. It says that she feels hated.
She doesn't. She feels just she was hated, and one wonders how much resentment Yaakov has. His plan was not to marry four women. This was not the plan. He said there was that moment of nuclear explosion when he saw Rachel, and to a certain degree, everything else is distracting him from that. And so it's just always a little bit heartbreaking to me, this scene.
Yes. I have a daughter named Leia. Okay. My daughter Leia says to me just yesterday or the day before, she says to me, Ishai, she says, Abba, she says, Abba, Leia is not exactly like a great character. She like started saying to me like she's jealous and she's got issues. And I said to her, listen to me, Leichka. Leia is a hidden tzaddik. Here's the fact. The fact is that Leia lays with Yaakov in Maarat Machpelah, and that Leia has Levites and the Kohanim all come from Leia, and the kingship of Israel come from Leia. There's something about Leia which the Bible, the Torah is not telling us, something mysterious, something incredibly holy about her, that she's able to conceive these children that are the really the chosen ones.
One of the ways to understand that is that Rachel is actually Yaakov's wife, whereas Leia is the wife of Yisrael.
Wow.
And there's a lot to be said to that because, of course, Yisrael is eternal, right? And that's why they lay together in Maarat Machpelah, whereas Yaakov, to a certain degree, is the process, and that's why Rachel is buried along the way.
So, as I was saying about the two conception aids, the other one is the way that Yaakov gets rich. He gets rich through figuring out, God gives him a clue into, speaking of the invasion nation, animal, he figures out animal husbandry. He figures out how to multiply his sheep. And also one of these stories that's hard to exactly understand what exactly it's saying. Did you get the spotted ones? Did you not? Who got the spotted ones?
Did he take the spotted ones? Did he not take the spotted ones yet?
It's always hard for me. I'm always kind of struggling with it a little bit. But for the sake of this program today, The bottom line is that through usage of especially kind of cut sticks that were placed in the ponds, the watering holes, the sheep and the goats, the flock
multiplied
greatly, and he became wealthy.
You know, there is a third conception method, which is a very important dimension here, and that's prayer, right? I mean, one of the most heartrending scenes of the whole very heartrending parsha is when Rachel comes to Yaakov and says, "If I don't have children, I'm going to die. You need to pray for me just like your father prayed for your mother." And Yaakov looks at her and says, "Well, I'm God to give you children." And the unstated part of that the Midrash fills in is when my father prayed for children from Rivka, he didn't have any children. I have children. God hasn't held children back from me. He's held children back from you.
Oh.
Yeah, that hurts.
It's just so, it's so, you know, and people, when you get into the studying the Torah, it's so dramatic. It's so amazing. So real. And I always like to say our characters are the character of the Torah are real challenges, real problems, real people. Any case, he gets rich. His father-in-law starts to get jealous of him. And the face of the father-in-law's servants, of Laban's, Lavan's servants, are not like they were before. And Lavan's face is not the way it was earlier. And at the same time, another thing happens, and that is Joseph is born. Yes, God hears Rachel, and Joseph is born. Something goes off in both these events at the same time. Something goes off in Yaakov's mind. We got to go. We got to get. And in fact, what's going to happen is one of my favorite verses in the whole Torah is that what happens is that Jacob is going to gather his two wives to the field. By the way, you're right here. Again, the two wives. I think it's the two wives, right? Yeah, I think it's the two wives.
Yeah, because it speaks to them about their father.
Right. Right. That's him. Right. That's right. You're right. That's right. He calls Yaakov. Yaakov calls Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flocks. Let's have a little Let's have a little panim el panim, a face to face
family talk.
A little family talk, right? A little family moment. He says, "Look, you guys know that I have been faithful to your father this whole time, and he has tried to trick me tens of times. Okay, he has tried to trick me every single time. You know that he is." What did you call it before? Trickster, what did you call it?
Deceiver.
The deceiver. And I have gotten rich. And then also he says, God came to me and he said to me the following words. Here's one of my favorite verses in the whole Torah. Anochi ha'el beit el. I am the God of the house of God. I am the God of, remember 20 years ago, me and you? Remember that? You were all alone. You didn't have a big family. Remember that time? I'm calling you back. Right? There is where you anointed the stone. That is where you made a neder, a vow. Now get up and leave this land and return to your homeland, He just says it to him. He's like, God comes back to him and he gives him this like vision. It's time for you. I helped you get rich. I helped you get your family. I helped you get rich. But now it's time for you to come back home.
Always makes me wonder, was he hearing from God before this? I mean, it seems to me that the silence there is almost deafening. I mean, the drama of his life up until now has been bound up with God. I mean, he grew up in the household where his grandfather was Abraham, his father was Isaac. You know, he's playing around with birthrights and blessings, and there was a prophecy bound up with his conception and all kinds of crazy stuff. And then he has this vision of the ladder. And 20 years, he's just working.
He's just working, raising the kids. He's dealing with family issues, dealing with family,
and then suddenly, it really makes me think to a certain degree that that again of that original encounter, like, he wasn't planning it, he didn't really aim for it, and here it's just a shattering moment when he realizes that's what this has all been for. God says, "Great, now you've got it." And it might be worth it, as we're already in the month of Kislev, in the month which we're leading up to Hanukkah, just to note the power of Yosef as part of this process. Because Yosef will be that ability of Yaakov to really extend into the future. Yosef will be his ability to connect to the world.
As the verse in Ovadiah, in Obadiah says, it says, Yaakov is going to be like a fire, but Yosef is like a flame. And I think the word flame means a more controlled fire, a more shaped fire,
But Rashi says it's sholet mirachok, right? I mean that the difference is that the flame is what actually bursts out and is able to consume his enemies. It's also what connects to that from outside of himself.
It's interesting because I think of it a little bit the opposite. Like Jacob is this like nuclear emotional explosion. Joseph is not. He's a little bit more like. Like, you can control that flame. That flame is like...
Well, take it up with Rashi.
Yeah, I'll take it up with Rashi. As his grandchildren did, and his in-laws.
It's a well-established tradition.
That's right. The great, great Rashi. Any case, it's time to run. Now, you've packed up the kids in the minivan, haven't you? Right?
I never really thought of this story in that context.
Go run now with your four wives.
Quickly.
Yeah. Four wives slash... what is it?
11 kids
at this time.
11 boys,
and not to mention a lot of sheep. Okay, and goats.
Pack them ten.
You know, and he does run away. This word, livroach, returns that he runs away. He doesn't say, "All right, folks, been great hanging out with you in Haran. I want to thank all of you guys." And no, it's not like that. He's not showing the PowerPoint and the picture slides. None of that. He's out of there. And it's his father-in-law. Now, respect, his father-in-law may be a conniving trickster, but at the same time...
He took him in,
and that's the grandfather of his wives and grandfather of his children.
And sister of his mother, and brother of his mother.
That's right. So it's family. So he's it's really a painful thing that's happening here.
But it's a core part of his personality. I mean, he was taught by his mother that when things get bad, you cut and run. Right? It's only... in the coming parsha, when he actually has to struggle to stand his ground, that he's going to transform out of Yaakov into Yisrael. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that this is what happens here.
That's right. And Lavan gives chase. Now the Baal HaTurim talks about the fact that it was Amalek who told Lavan that, guess what? Jacob's heading the land of Israel, and that's very dangerous for Amalek. We're going to learn about that later. Amalek wants to stop the Jewish people from coming back to the land of Israel. He wants to stop Jacob from coming in. And what happens is that Lavan hears about this in a three-day delay, and yet he makes haste, probably not lugging with him four wives and 11 kids and a lot of sheep and flock. He makes haste, and he's got a posse, and they catch up to Yaakov at the end. And basically, there's yet more family unpleasantness when Jacob says to him, like, look, man, Lavan is going to say, hey, why'd you steal my grandkids? Oh, and P.S., another sub-story here, Rachel steals the idolatrous...
Objects,
the trophim. Have you heard of the word trophy? It's the exact same word. Trophy and trophim is exactly the same word. And she steals these trophies that he had, according to the one Medrash, they are talking heads. They are cut-off heads that you put like a kamea under their tongue and they tell you the future. And she is...
useful?
It could be very useful. It's hanging on your wall, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall type of thing. So she steals his idolatrous trophies, and they're on the run. And finally, Lavan is going to encounter him, and he's going to say, why did you steal my grandkids? Why did you steal my trophies?
This is a turning point in Jewish history, and I think it's important to emphasize that because, you know, on Seder night, on the night of Passover, right, we will read in the Haggadah, Lavan bikesh lakor et hakol. Right? Lavan wanted to uproot everything. And a simple reading of the story, it just doesn't bear it out. Like, what do you mean he wanted to uproot everything?
Right.
I mean, some people often read that he came like with the desire to kill everybody he caught, which is a little bit difficult because, as you pointed out, they are his daughters and grandchildren.
What
he means here is if you look in the 31st chapter in the 43rd line, mm-hmm. Lavan's response to Yaakov is V'yan Lavan v'yomer. Right, he answers Yaakov and says, "Habanot benotai, habanim banai, v'hatzon tzoni v'chol asher atare lihu."
Everything,
right? Everything is mine. Meaning what? You're no different than me. You're no different than me, right? There's nothing special about you. It's true, you're a nice guy, you're good at what you do, but don't deceive yourself into thinking you're somehow different. And as far as I can tell, this is the greatest challenge that the Jewish people have faced through time, and it's certainly one which stands amongst all the ones that we're facing today, which is, are we just the same as everybody else, right? That Yaakov faced this moment of Lavan telling him, listen, you think God talked to you? You think God wants you to go to some specific place in order to do some specific thing? Come on. Everybody's the same. I'll prove it to you. These are my daughters. Those are my grandkids. Yeah, and this is the moment in which Lavan really tried to erase the very special destiny of the Jewish people.
And Yaakov says to him, listen, you've been a trickster. You've been conniving. You've been thieving for me all this time.
Low down dirty rat.
What's that?
Low down dirty rat.
He says that to him, and at the end they come to a strange amicable agreement. They make a wall. They make
yep.
a wall, and that wall says like, and who paid for that wall? I don't know. I think, but what I know is they made a wall, and they basically said, don't come into my territory. I won't come into yours. And then Lavan's like, he makes him swear like, don't mistreat my daughters.
Yes.
Don't mistreat my daughters. Treat them right.
Which is another beautiful moment. Whereas Lavan gets a little bit nuanced in his character there, because it might just be in a simple sense here. He was worried. You know, this guy takes off in the middle of the night with his kids and his grandkids. Well, why didn't he stay and say goodbye? Maybe he has bad intentions.
So they make this tent, and indeed it says that Yaakov and his he told his brothers, gather stones, and this is an interesting thing. Could it be that the children were already like the brothers, or maybe the camp that came with Lavan? Any case, they call it in both. It has two names, basically, like two sides of this border. One is called Yigar Sahaduta, and the other one is called Galed, and that's a modern Hebrew word today, which means like an eternal.
A testimony, a pile of testimony.
Pile of testimony, that's right.
It's a witness marker.
A witness marker. Again, maybe a third stone, a third type of stone object in this week's Torah portion.
Yeah.
And they make this distance between one another. And finally, what happens is that Lavan leaves and returns to his place. But Jacob came in, kind of started coming towards the land of Israel. Suddenly, in a very cryptic line, he sees the angels of God. And when Jacob sees this angels of God, he calls the place Machanaim, which means a godly camp. This Machanaim is like, what does really Machanaim really mean?
It means two camps.
Two camps.
And it's not just that he saw them. Once again, we have this line, they encountered him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the... that's the essence of the difference. When he was on his way out, he encountered the land. He encountered the place. Right? He came because he realized what he was losing as he was leaving it. Right? And now, Malachi Elohim, right, they encounter him because he's coming into the fullness of himself, which is why God is calling him back to the land, because the two are meant to be together, right? And they encounter him, so to speak, as something completely new. And these two camps, on some level, I mean, the Midrash says that it's the camp of angels that escorted him outside of the land, and the one that were waiting to greet him as he entered.
There's a different set of angels here in the land of Israel.
Yes.
It's a different set of angels.
Because it's a different expression of divine will.
Right.
Right?
And then, by the way, I just want to, this reminds me just for a second, parenthetically, and then let you finish the phrase, and we got to finish up. But I just want to say that I am flying out next week. I'm not going to be with you next week on the Spiritual Cafe. I'm flying out, and I pray right now that the angels of the land of Israel will escort me on a mission for the land of Israel. So I will be in San Francisco and New York. I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of our friends, including my friends Jack and Sarah, who underwrite the show as well, who help us so much, and my friend Moshe, and many others that I'm going to see in San Francisco, in New York, in New Jersey. So I hope to see you there as well. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com.
I was just going to finish by saying that these two camps are already setting up for us the drama of his re-encounter with his brother Esav, which will revolve around two camps as well.
All right. So that's been a very, very powerful parsha, but it's been an inclusio, meaning to say the beginning and the end of the parsha are thematically linked. It's the leaving of Jacob, his life that he created outside of the land of Israel, and then his yearning to come back, his trek back, the galut, the exile will chase after him, okay? They'll chase after him, demanding something. He'll make a border between himself and them, and then he'll come into the land of Israel with this new family and start to encounter the angels that he said goodbye to all the way when he left Beit El. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to thank you for this elucidating and wonderful conversation about the Torah portion of Vayetze. Very powerful stuff, and it's also very, very pertinent to us in the story of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel.
Bezrat Hashem, you're welcome. Shabbat Shalom, Yitzhak.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. We have yet more good content on the show today with Avi Zimmerman, so don't touch that dial, whatever. Don't touch that iPad. Don't touch that. Whatever you're doing.
That screen.
That screen. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected. And Shalom. Rabbi Mike, thanks again.
Shalom.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement, way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, and right now I'm in one of the most wonderful places. I'm in the food court of the Hadar Mall in Talpiot, Jerusalem. There's a little girl on one of those carousels of the horses. There's a fresh juice place with a guy with a crazy haircut and a lot of bananas. There's an Asian food place, a burger ranch, which is, has a strange symbol of what looks like a kind of idolatrous bull there. There's a Zuka, where I just had some excellent pizza. And interesting, right next to Zuka, there's a Chuka, and that's the Asian food place. There's a lot of funny places. There's also a big electronics store behind me, which is called Alam. It's a big network of stores here in the country, and there's a lot of flat-screen TVs. People around me look happy. Israelis, which are, by the way, Arabs and Jews, especially here in Jerusalem, are looking good. They're well-dressed. One guy behind me is obviously a Russian Jew. Another group is obviously some Arab folks. There's Ethiopians. There's just all kinds of folks. And you know what? The country looks great. And the reason I say this is because, oh, there's a Chabad guy over there trying to strap some tefillin on somebody, some unsuspecting suspect that hasn't put on his phylacteries this morning. There's all kinds of people here. And one of the things that is so obvious right now is that it's lively. It's alive. I dare say the word that sometimes offends people. It's sexy. And what I mean by that is not in any improper way. I mean to say there's a life force, a pulsating life force. Yet if you watch the media, you get the sense that Israel is all about conflict. There's no way that an Arab and a Jew could be sitting right next to each other in this food court, and that who knows what's going on. And certainly just about a kilometer away that way, Jerusalem is an occupied city by the evil Zionist regime. You can really get that by perusing the internet, certainly Twitter. I mean, hashtag whatever, Jerusalem. You'll find tons of hateful, spiteful, dark language. And that's one of the things that this show tries to fight in the efforts really of something called nation branding and Hasbara and all these kind of things. And yet somehow, while the Jewish people are the fathers and mothers of Zuckerberg and Spielberg, Becholzot, in any case, we still haven't managed to really make a dent, and the narrative warfare against Israel is at its zenith. One of the people that's fighting that is doing it both on the ground and in narrative war, both in the land of Israel and in an effort to create media consciousness, is my good friend Avi Zimmerman, who is the director of the American Friends of Ariel, and now a new project called Talk 17, which is dedicated to the understanding, the realization that 2017 is a confluence of many important dates, including 100 years since Balfour and 50 years since the Jewish people, did we liberate or occupy, liberation or occupation, in the West Bank, Judea, and Samaria, past the Green Line. Avi Zimmerman, welcome to the mall. And how was your Parv ice cream that you had at Burger Ranch?
It was as good as Parv ice cream can possibly be.
That's saying a lot, sir.
It looked like a big swirl on the top, and it looked like it was dairy. It almost tasted like it was also.
Right. I can't believe it's not milchik. That's like basically the Jewish dream for Shabbos post-lunch snacks. Everybody knows that. Avi, we're in the food court, and really, I'm looking around, it just has so much life and beauty. Really so rich, and yet so often it's portrayed in such darkness. Ariel University and the town of Ariel is certainly the opposite. When you get there, you see this big, beautiful town. You see an incredibly lively university that's bringing in the average Israeli to study with a Zionistic bent. Not a religious bent, but a Zionistic bent. Tell me a little bit about Talk 17, this effort of yours to kind of create a new focal point of media and words that will give people a different perspective.
Well, thanks. The truth is, Yishai, it's the challenge here is, like you said, the rules of the game have been written by other people. And how then do we kind of insert ourselves into that conversation? Well, guess what? We don't, in my humble opinion, only because the rules have been written. The doors or the locks on those doors have been situated in such a way that we're not really given access. A lot of people say, well, why is Israel's, you mentioned the word Hasbara. I'm not a crazy fan of the word Hasbara. It doesn't matter. Why is Israel's Hasbara so poor? And part of the reason is even when you get your act together, nobody wants to listen. Not that the average consumer of media doesn't want to listen, but the gatekeepers aren't interested in letting you get inside. And so, well, maybe what we really have to do is create alternative gates and alternative platforms.
And we are living in a time where that is possible.
Correct.
Which is an amazing thing. Let me tell you a quick story. I think I might have told it to my folks last week or something. But just very quickly, I meet a bus driver. I was given a tour, and I was sitting at the table with the bus driver and stuff. And you know how the bus drivers in Israel are. They're all geniuses. I'm sitting with him. We're talking. He points to his phone. He says to me, "This thing saved my life." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Listen, I thought I was all alone with my nationalistic, strong on Israel opinions." And he kind of threw it out there, but I don't know if he meant it seriously. He was like, "I was contemplating suicide."
Wow.
I don't know what he meant by that. He may have just been exaggerating, but I could see in his face that maybe that was an exaggeration, but he did feel that lonely.
Wow.
And he said to me, "But I found Facebook, and I found that I'm not alone at all. I'm not alone at all." And that goes to say, by the way, that the Israeli media is quite unfriendly sometimes to nationalistic tendencies. But the bottom line is that he found himself in these new methods of communicating. And that's what you're talking about as well.
It's true. I actually think that the alternative methods are becoming the primary.
Right.
And you can see it in the stats and traditional. Certainly people aren't buying newspapers anymore. What are they consuming? They're consuming what they choose to consume. So we kind of have to enter into that space. There's that new opportunity. And the question is then, how do we do it? And the part of the problem is we've got wonderful people, yourself being one of them, who find ways to create these platforms, but then we, not you, Yishai, but many, they're still stuck in the same rut by the same rules that other people wrote for them with the old school methods of media. And what I mean is, well, we kind of think that we're, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, and our main objective is to teach the world, to educate, to prove to them who's right and by default who's wrong. And that's critical, important, makes a lot of sense, but that's not necessarily how we win if we want to be ahead of the curve. We live in a postmodern world, and in this postmodern world, we need to be doing things that are about the conversation per se, meaning if I were to identify what I think the greatest challenge is, let's say as we look towards 2017 and beyond, it's not whether Israel is right. Okay, we know that we're right. That's great. It's whether the world has access to us and us to them. That is the objective. So if the boycotters, let's say, are interested in delegitimizing us by isolating us, so then our objective is to be non-isolated. It's to be legitimate, not to be right. We don't have to be right. We just have to be part of the conversation. That's the theory behind it. And if that's true, well, then what better way than not only to join the conversation, but to create the platform? And that's really what this whole Talk 17 thing is. But Talk 17 could be one of many efforts in this same direction.
You know, Avi, I really appreciate your words very much. One thing that has really changed in the last 100 years, other than everything and the whole communications revolution and just the way we reach out to people, one irony is that as the Jewish people come back home to the land of Israel and are geographically more isolated, the world is becoming more able to hear our message, much more. I'm much more able to send out a picture from Israel right now than Mark Twain was with his writing 150 years ago. It's an incredible thing. Is the more we ingather, the more we can broadcast. But on the other hand, there is something that has gone down tremendously, and that is a knowledge of the Bible. Now, why do I say that? Because if you're a Bible reader, i.e. everybody 150 years ago, then Israel is cool. Israel's the protagonist. If you would be merchandising it, you would be wearing not the Philistine T-shirt, but you would be wearing the Go David T-shirt. You know, not the Goliath T-shirt, unless you're dark like that, goth. But the point is that we have lost a certain advantage in narrative. How do we get it back? Because we're not like any longer seen, like, because nobody knows the Bible, they no longer think, oh, those are those people. That's cool. I'm connecting them. And notice, by the way, the people that do know Bible are the ones who are like, oh, that's cool.
Right.
We have lost a certain narrative advantage. Now make it into the high-tech world. Okay, so you made a cell phone. Well, great. Or you have gay rights. Great. Or you go to Haiti. Great. But like, how do we get back on that wit? Because the image that our enemies have carved out for us in narrative warfare is the image of occupier, abuser, and really just conniving, tricky, and bad.
Yeah, it's an amazing question. I would say first, I would actually flip around the paradigm for just a second. I do think that when we come back here, we have the opportunity to be broadcasting to the world. I don't really think that the world doesn't care. I think they do. I think the disproportionate engagement in what goes on in Israel is a testimony to that. I think, let's put it this way, I think we might have talked about this in the past on a different occasion. If you give me two options, do I prefer the person who totally and completely ignores Israel or the person who despises Israel? I personally prefer the person who despises Israel because it means that they're connecting. If you ignore somebody...
Is that an exaggeration, though?
It depends on the context. I don't want the person who despises Israel who's strapped with a bomb.
It's interesting.
That's not the kind of enemy I'm looking for.
I tell people, like students on campus, I say to them, listen, when you meet the guy who hates Israel, don't worry about him. Don't deal with him too much because he's out of the game. He's a hater. Deal with the people who are, you know, still don't know and are virgin territory can still be.
It's a really good question. I think sometimes apathetic, that's fine. Let them go to the mall, not in Jerusalem, but in their hometown in the United States, and let them go shopping, and that's fine. I'm cool with that. I really don't care. Let them live their own lives. But the people who are tuning in, it's not up to me or you, Yishai. You know what? This is what our Christian friends call a God thing. This is divine intervention.
God thing, I think I love
you. The world is tuning into Israel, not because you and I chose for them to tune into Israel, just because there are, because there's no other logical explanation to it. One of the paradigms I do try to share with, again, my Christian friends, and I hate to say just my Christian friends, but in my experience in REL, the people who visit us, and I'm going to say something that's overgeneralization, and I'm going to regret having said it on radio in a few moments, but generally my Jewish visitors are interested in politics. My Christian visitors are interested in the Bible.
Oh, of course. I was at a synagogue in Toronto one time, and I said to them, oh, it was Sunday morning brunch, and then at night I was speaking at a church, and I said to them, all right, this morning we'll talk Israeli politics. Tonight when I go to church, we'll talk Torah.
There you go. So, so that's just the way it is. Anyway, so when I speak to my my friends, I talk to them about Hawaii, and I say if God created the whole world, and he knew, he had the ultimate, the Uber GPS, he knew where everything was located, why didn't he choose Hawaii as the chosen land for the chosen people?
Well, they say the 10 tribes ended up there. That's what Aloha is, like Eloka.
Okay, they say the 10 tribes ended up a lot of places. It may be. Yeah. Apparently, they got around to a lot of different places. Maybe there as well. But Hawaii is a great place, sure. And they have pina coladas.
Right.
And I know you love the palm trees, Yishai.
Sure, sure.
But the obviously, you know, the answer is there in the question. Well, one second. If God put a smack in the middle of absolutely everything,
right.
East, West, Africa, Asia, Europe, crossroads, literally, figuratively, it means he wants us to be part of the conversation. And every time we try to duck out of it and hide our heads in the sand,
right.
He makes sure it comes right back to us. And it's right. Always there. And so then again, it gets to the same question we asked before. Not whether people are tuning in, but what are the platforms that are available?
Mm-hmm. So we've touched on a lot of interesting questions. You're now creating a new platform called Talk 17, and if you search Talk 17 and REL in the same sentence, it'll jump right up on Facebook and on a website. Talk 17 is a kind of TED Talk, a kind of TED Talk platform, where you're going to bring 8 speakers at every one of these sessions to really talk for 15 minutes about Israel, about this region, and about how we could better it, how we could make it really lively and alive.
Yeah, well, the idea is to do two things which are kind of different than one from another. One is to add depth, and the other is to add breadth. So depth, meaning I hear about the headlines from the outside, and like you said, this experience here inside the mall is completely different than the way people are looking at it from the outside.
I wish right now people were in this mall with me right now. Just to see the colors and the types of people, the types of haircuts, there's such a true, simple life.
It's just real.
It's just real.
Here it's real, and there is no way to detect that unless, you know what, even the people who sometimes visit, they're so accustomed to what they've been trained to think, they can't even see what's in front of them until, I don't know, somebody interacts.
Let's talk about the elephant in the mall for a second, and that elephant is the issues of... You mentioned that sometimes Jews play by the old rules, Israelis, the fight for Israel. One of the things that nobody seems to really want to hit in narrative war is the accusation of our time, which is specifically about Judea and Samaria, specifically about the West Bank. It is a recurring accusation. It is everywhere. It's about the settlements, the West Bank, and just this week. Just this week right now, State Department is condemning, the State Department of the United States of America is condemning potential laws being passed in Knesset. Does anybody understand what I mean when I say this sentence? They're condemning our democratically elected leaders who are crafting a law that they think is important to represent the people, and the State Department is condemning our democratic processes. There's like nobody understands the unbelievable moment that we're facing here. What I mean to say by that is that the rights of Jews in Judea and Samaria, the idea of Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank, is the one that is being recurrently challenged on a spectrum of challenges from far, far extremists who are, you know, the Nazi, neo-Nazi like efforts, jihadist efforts, to State Department. I mean, our best friend, the height of legitimacy. These are suit and tie people. Not to mention the Euros, who I call them the legitimate arm of the jihad, the UNESCOs of this world. And I Talk 17 wants to also deal with macro issues, but also specifically about the rights of Jewish people in Judea and Samaria. It is based in Ariel, which is the capital of Samaria, and of course a very successful town, one which is a model town in so many ways, and also a very inclusive town. So let's talk a little bit about that specific challenge that's being issued.
Right. Well, there's at least two elements to that. Number one, from a policy issue, from a policy perspective, you know, State Department and all, that's something we don't want to touch upon. The only way we would, and we do plan a series on alternatives to the so-called two-state solution.
Right.
Because the only thing we know about that is that it's not a solution. And I don't think your listeners need to hear me go off on that, so we can leave that alone for now. But we need to, yes, visit what those alternatives might be. That's kind of a small piece about what we're talking about. Essentially, the idea is to focus on the people living in the region and hear from them themselves. It'll all be in English, but the idea is to make sure that the voices are authentic. Don't talk about me, listen to me. And by the way, I'm going to be listening to people that aren't me, right, people that I don't agree with. Their platform will be large enough. This platform will be large enough for these, broad enough for these people to have a voice as well.
All right, so that's Talk 17. Look up Talk 17 and Ariel, and also there's an Indiegogo campaign right now with a fantastic video with our dear friend Avi Zimmerman here.
Indiegogo on generosity. It's their nonprofit.
Indiegogo on
generosity,
kind of thing, yes. On the Yishai Fleischer Show here in Jerusalem on the Land of Israel Network. Of course. Indiegogo generosity, and that is Talk 17. Check it out. It's a great video. With Avi, by the way, which itself makes a lot of points itself as a type of platform. That's great to use generosity under Indiegogo as a type of media platform to talk about our issues. That in itself is revolutionary. Let's shift gears for a second and talk about one more topic in the time that we have here in the mall. The ice cream is calling to me. I want to stop this radio show and just get some of these fruit juices. By the way, the mall, once you start walking around here, you realize you really want to buy a lot of stuff. So that's why I remind people to try to support the Yishai Fleischer Show by going to our donate page and also to the Land of Israel Network and all of our great shows. Help us out. Be part of the story. Let's talk a little bit about a guy who doesn't need our fiscal support, and that's Donald Trump, president-elect. You know, I'm not following every minute detail of the Donald Trump story right now in America. I was following almost daily the issues of the elections. Once he got elected, I'm already back to focusing on my issues. What I have noticed, though, is that he has taken very serious steps in bringing into the administration what even the left are admitting, people, his opponents are admitting, are serious people with serious track records and serious management, government and management skills. That's pretty cool. Here in Israel, some people, the newspapers, wanted to paint some kind of euphoria in the nationalist camp. I think that was an exaggeration. I think there was a general happiness because there was a sense that this person tends much more to be generally on our side of the spectrum as opposed to the Democrats these days, who, as we could see also with the effort to elect Ellison to the DNC, who is pretty much an anti-Israel dude. I mean, I don't mean to exaggerate just what it seems like to me. I don't know him that clearly, but for everything I've seen so far. But in any case, I wanted to kind of ask you to get down a little bit. We talked in the last the Torah section with Rabbi Mike Foer, Spiritual Cafe. We talked a little bit about the ladder of Jacob, where the head was in the clouds, but the feet were grounded. I want to get a little bit from a grounded perspective. What is Trump, the Trump thing to you? Let's call it the Trump revolution, or what I called it, the Trumpertunity, the opportunity, the Trumpertunity.
The Trumpertunity.
Yeah, the Trumpertunity. Is there, in fact, a Trumpertunity?
Well, I didn't tell you this, Yishai. I had a very interesting experience. I flew out of the U.S. back to Israel on Election Day. And so just imagine a whole plane load of people coming from the U.S. to Israel, not knowing when they take off who's going to be the president, because nobody knew, and landing right after the results. You know, I didn't think about this at first, because at the end of a long flight, you don't think about any of this stuff. But the guy one row ahead of me, he turns on his phone first, right? And he goes quickly to see what the results are. And he starts screaming, "Trump, Trump." Right? So we could have, everybody's like, "What's this guy talking about?"
Oh,
right?
My God.
So
that's so cool.
Everyone's like looking around. I look at my phone, and I must have gone so many shades of white, and I'm a pretty white guy.
Yeah, you're white.
It was Trump, and I said, okay, this is just Fox News. I'm going to look at CNN. They also said that Trump won. I couldn't believe it. So we're getting off the plane, right? And as we get off the plane, the captain gets on the loudspeaker, and he says, I want to thank the stewards and stewardesses, the staff, for doing such an amazing job. I haven't seen this in a long time, but everyone, as they're getting off the plane, everyone seems so happy. Now, the real reason... was that you had one airplane full of people on planet Earth that landed somewhere that was happy that Trump won. That was the plane of people that was either coming back home to Israel or people touring Israel. These people
or
were happy
people
about Trump
flying into
winning.
Idaho.
What, flying out of Idaho.
Idaho. Or
it was pretty cool, and it wasn't because it wasn't the right. It wasn't like it was a plane load of so-called settlers.
Right.
It was just the general vibe was, I think, just a sense of relief. We've had Israel had enough of the Obama administration, Israel on the whole, and they just didn't want to see that continue. But then you use the term, kind of moving into what you asked, the Trumpertunity. I think that's a great term because we do not know what the days that come will bring. We can be optimistic,
can I just say,
we do not know.
I just want to tell you about that term. I have a friend and a colleague who's a Rolfer, and he's one of the supporters of the show. Rolfing is a type of getting your body into alignment effort. And as he was working on my body, I was finally starting to relax after weeks and weeks of thinking about issues. And I was just—it was still rolling through my head. And by the way, it's facebook.com/IsraelRolfing, and suddenly, and that's Steve, Dr. Steve Brown. He's great, And he was wrong for me, and suddenly I was just thinking about these issues, and suddenly it just came to me, the Trumpertunity. It just popped into my head as that happened. I'm happy that I have a chance to make that plug also for Israel Rolfing, and that's exactly when the Trumpertunity came into my head.
Wow.
And I said to him, I'm like, hey, I just came up with Trumpertunity. He's like, that sounds good. I'm like, have you heard that before? He's like, no. I'm like, I got one.
It's official.
I got a hashtag.
You coined a new term. You coined a hashtag.
I coined a hashtag.
I'd like to
get some coins from my hashtag.
I want to be optimistic about the Trumpertunity, and the truth is I am, mainly because I think Israelis as a whole would like to see America kind of saying, you know what, you are our friend, and we're going to let our friends speak up a little bit. We talk about talking before. Speak up a little bit. We want to hear from you what you think is a good idea for Israel. We want to hear what you think is a good idea for your relationship with your neighbors. Because guess what? We live on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. We're going to support our friends. We're going to give you some space to figure things out. And by the way, this is the double-edged sword that's involved here. Because let's say we do get that space. Well, guess what? That's a lot harder than kvetching for 8 years about Obama. It's a lot easier to just be in the opposition and complain. And say, you know what, America or the American administration is not being fair. But what happens when you're not necessarily in the driver's seat, but you're a lot closer to it and you're allowed to speak? What happens then?
And opposition is much easier.
Opposition is so much easier.
Right. And we love that kind of stuff. We love to complain and yell about things and tell people, you know, how wrong they are. But actually being in the driver's seat, that's scary. Speaking of driver's seat. Yesterday, 2 days ago, I gave a talk at Habonim Dror, and out of my mouth flew a new paradigm, a new mashal, what do we call it, mashal?
You're coining phrases, you're coining hashtags, and now you have a new parable.
A new parable, that's the word. I said to them, they asked me about Arab rights in Israel, according to my five alternatives to the two-state solution discussion, and I said to them, look, I'm willing to give Arabs or any other Gentiles civil rights in this country to have a very decent life, maybe local elections, but I don't want to give them the vote to maneuver my country. This is a Jewish state. And so just like other minorities in other situations, like, for example, Puerto Rico cannot vote for the president of the United States. You know, there's alternative laws for certain territories. I said, let me give you a parable for that. I am a driver, and I'm willing to give a hitchhike, the tramp is the Hebrew word for hitchhike, to other people, and I want to make sure that they're safe. I want to make sure that they're comfortable. I want to make sure that they're seat-belted and clean seats, and I'll get them to their location, but I won't give them the wheel.
One second. Do you have clean seats in your car? Yishai, okay. Because you have kids.
All right. You caught me. You caught me on that one. You caught me. You're right. The seats aren't so clean. There's definitely some.
You would give them the cleaner seats, the ones with fewer Cheerios.
You know what? Just get in the car, okay? I gotcha. But the point is that you want my ride, you'll take the seats that I'm offering. The bottom line is, though, is that that's the kind of idea that I have. Look, you can have a place in the car, but the control of this, especially since we're a defensive state and a minority in this region, we can't give up that kind of control to anybody, really.
Interesting. Wow. I haven't thought about the car parable. It's really an interesting one, but I think if I understand you correctly, you're talking about the driver's seat. You're talking about responsibility, and I think that's ultimately, by the way, what we're talking about here. One of the main differences, again, between old school pro-Israel and what I'd like to think is current, is guess what? We have responsibility. Don't get me wrong. I'm not being paternalistic and, oh, well, now let's give jobs to the people who don't have jobs. And yes, I do mean let's take responsibility, though. We're not doing it because we feel bad for people. We're doing it because if we want to see a future for this state, we need to, 100%. Like we said, step into the driver's seat.
100%. If you're the sovereign, you're responsible for other people. Simple
correct.
As that.
Correct.
Simple
it's that. Easier. It's easier to complain, sit on the sidelines, say, you know what, they're not giving me anything, and then kind of just divvy it all up amongst yourselves. You know what? It costs money to provide services
100%.
For everyone.
100%.
And that is
money,
a big responsibility.
And it's
easier to shy away from it.
And especially because there's many people in those parts that don't want us there and don't want us to take that responsibility.
But I actually wonder what the numbers are on that.
That's right.
That's a very fair question, and maybe some fair polling would give some further information about that.
Right. But, honest polling.
But the question is fair, and you know what? Sometimes people don't like you, but you still provide for them because that's like, you know, that's sometimes it's like being a parent, and sorry for not being paternalistic, but perhaps in some ways, yes, it is true nonetheless. It's not a simple situation. It's something that Israel is going to have to figure out. But again, I think Israel is going to have to figure it out.
Avi Zimmerman, I think that the Talk 17 video that people got to check out and the Indiegogo campaign on generosity will give you a real sense. The first thing you'll see Avi a little bit. That's a lot of fun. And you'll also see this effort to get a new platform going and a new movement. Maybe you'll donate or maybe you'll attend or maybe you'll speak. Who knows? But there are incredible opportunities here with this new era and with the old era of old paradigms like the two-state solution and a small and weak Israel or, I don't know, all the other paradigms that are here are starting to really clearly leave the fold. There's the death throes of the old regime. They're trying to hold on strong, but they're going the way of the cuckoo. You're talking about the Trump opportunities, and that is could be, and we hope that there is a Trump opportunity. But in any case, a more important word is our own responsibility. Avi Zimmerman, it's time for us to get some dessert here in the mall, in the Hadar Mall in Talpiot, Jerusalem. I want to thank you so much for coming out.
My pleasure, Yishai. Looking forward to next time.
All right, folks. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. We hope to hear from you. We hope to connect. When you write me an email, it makes all the difference. Oh, yeah, and write in the email subject line, I'm a listener, or I am a listener. I already have a few emails that I got to read from you. I'll do it next week. We ran out of time. God bless you, folks, wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Stay part of the story. God bless you, and shalom.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour, experience that you could possibly have is to go with Hayovel. Now it's weird, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to Hayovel.com.
Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Radio Network at thelandofisrael.com. Make sure you check out my show every Monday, bringing you the news unfiltered and uncensored, information that you are not getting anywhere else, especially not in the mainstream media.
Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.